Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty, and we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast when John Lennon and Yoko Ono put out Sometime in New York City back in 1972. There was a second half to the album, which was a live explosion of material recorded between the years of 1969 and 1971. And we are here in a bonus capacity to our Sometime in New York City episodes to discuss this bonus material. Is it really an intrinsic part of the album, or is it an extra part of the album, or why is it there? Does the album not stand on its own two feet? It first came out on CD in 1987 in a lovely big double Fat Boy, Fat Box CD case, and then the 2005 CD dropped the live material altogether and instead put on Happy Christmas, War Is Over and Listen, the Snow Is Falling. And then the 2010 CD went back to being a double CD with the live album as well. Why isn't it a standalone release? Or, you know, it wasn't like, oh, here's maybe the Fillmore stuff is kind of New York-y, but it's not 1972. It's not even contemporaneous with an album whose whole point is being contemporaneous with what's going on. Get it out there. I suppose they'd put out Live Peace in Toronto, so they kind of had a noisy live record out already. Maybe they thought they couldn't do another standalone. At the same time, though, you know, Sometime in New York City could, it is its own kind of concept album. It steps out of the concept, but the live stuff there a bit.
What I would say is, you know, the Zappa stuff is New York. That's the Fillmore. That's that. So that fits in. The UNICEF benefit, there is a little bit of kind of protesty element to what's happening on that side. So I suppose to that extent, perhaps it fits in with the general protest vibe of the main album.
That's as good a case as I think I'm going to get. So let's look at it. So as we said, the live part of Sometime in New York City is broken down into two halves, a 1969 half recorded at a UNICEF benefit and a 1971 half where John and Yoko crash into the world of Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. So the UNICEF benefit part, it's kind of, they didn't know it at the time, but it's an important gig.
It is so important for, you know, a couple of reasons. It's Lennon's last performance in the UK, and it's the last time George and John will appear on stage together.
And it happens, you know, in November 1969. And even though it's been released and out there, you kind of gets lost in the whole 1969 story of the Beatles, that right at the end of the year, John and George share the stage in London and perform some songs. It's not immediately what springs to mind when you think of 69 and the Beatles.
This should be more important, or should be regarded as being more important. And it's the fact that it is bonus material on what was probably John Lennon's least successful, least loved album. So it's hidden away. But yeah, there's a lot going on at the end of 1969 in Apple, you know, which we covered in detail. And this is just another event as part of John and Yoko's peace campaign, their media, I was going to say manipulation, but their sort of brand, creating their brand in the media. This is just one more event. And this isn't even an event at which they were scheduled to play initially.
Well, that's the thing. It happens in December 69. Mm. I think I said it happens in November 69. It's announced in November 69. And it's announced that they are performing at it, which is news to John and Yoko.
So this is United Nations benefit concert, and it's been organised. There's a lineup, and they announced that John and Yoko will be there. And of course, they haven't got John to sign anything. You know, he's not teed up to do this. There's Apple are involved to some extent in that the Hot Chocolate Band, who are an Apple artist, will be there.
And that we should point out that is the Hot Chocolate, the band who became 70s. Disco, hot funk,
sexy thing.
That's the song that comes to mind. I Believe in Miracles. Everyone's a Winner, Baby. That Hot Chocolate. I once again, just to step in for a sec, the parallel history of Apple Records, where you actually realised that they had James Taylor and Hot Chocolate, who were two very big selling acts in the 70s, and they let them walk out the door.
They didn't know what to do with them.
They did not know what to do with them.
Well, they did. They put them on at the Lyceum with John and Yoko.
which is what you wanted. It was a good lineup at the Lyceum that night.
It was a very good lineup.
Young Rascals,
Groovin,
Desmond Dekker,
Shantytown,
Blue Mink, and Black Velvet.
Melting Pot.
Were Blue Mink? Were they the Melting Pot gang?
Yes.
Was that them?
Blue Mink.
Ah, okay. And you can't get away with playing Melting Pot on the radio anymore. I don't think
I'll drop a little 10-second.
Don't. Okay. No, I think that my memory serves that there was some local radio DJ in Britain who played Melting Pot in the middle of the day recently, and it's a song. It's got very good intentions about all the world's a great big melting pot, but it sort of doesn't really lyrically pass muster in 2022.
Okay,
you know, it's hearts in the right
people
place.
Can go off and explore and find this themselves, but we are in no way sending them off to do that.
No, not really. But it's a good lineup. It's a proper charity benefit show.
You think if you'd been there to hear Give Peace a Chance, the reggae version by Hot Chocolate, Groovin by the Rascals, a bit of Shantytown by Desmond Dekker, and then suddenly you get John and Yoko coming on stage. That's a weird lineup.
And, you know, you're thinking, well, Come Together is kind of still in the charts. It might get a bit of Come Together. So, you know, it's been a couple of Beatles hits this year. We might get the Ballad of John and Yoko because, you know, they might be bringing their pop music chops. It doesn't really play out that way.
It does not play out that way. So this is called Peace for Christmas. And it's a UNICEF gig. John and Yoko agree to take part because they realise this is a happening. This could be one of their events. I'm tempted to say they hijack the event, but they agree to participate.
Yes, and they've already done the Rock and Roll Festival in Toronto in September, the famous one where, you know, John puts together a band at the last minute and decides on the plane that he's going to leave the Beatles, blah blah blah, and he's kind of looking at doing a version of pulling together kind of the same people again and doing the same thing again, right?
Yeah, more or less. It's the same basic lineup plus Billy Preston. That's the lineup that they settle on. It changes on the night because a few friends turn up. All this is held at the Lyceum, what was then the Lyceum Ballroom, which is just the Lyceum now. You'll have been to see The Lion King in the Lyceum.
I've actually never set foot in the Lyceum. The Lion King has currently been showing there in London in the West End for, I don't know, the last 20-odd years, I guess. It's also the famous venue. It used to have a retractable roof, and it's where Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry and his famous Live at the Lyceum album was recorded. So it was kind of this kind of dance hall music venue up until the 80s, I think.
Yeah. So my fun fact here is the Lyceum was the location where Love Me Do was first played to the public.
How so?
Tony Calder was a DJ, and whereas everybody in Liverpool in their lunch hour went to the Cavern, everybody in London went to the Lyceum. And he kind of, you know, spun some discs.
Spanned.
and he was promoting this, and that's the first place it was ever played. So last concert appearance by Lennon, and first place Love Me Do. It's all connected.
it's all connected. That's quite a nice fact in the space of, I guess we're talking the space of 7 years, that amazingly short timeline. So, yes.
Well, it was also the home of the Miss World competition. Let's not forget that when we're talking about...
talking about class acts.
The Miss World contest was staged every year from 1951 to 1968. And the fun fact is 1968 was the last Miss World competition to be televised in black and white and was the first to allow married ladies to compete.
I think it then moved to the Royal Albert Hall because there was the famous Bob Hope incident in 1971, which is a fantastic story on its own. There was a documentary about it last year about how Bob Hope was interrupted. So John is planning to bring Eric Clapton, Klaus Voormann, Alan White with them, who were with Toronto, and Billy Preston in the band. So you got John Lennon and Billy Preston together. But some friends turn up in kind of a preview of 1980s Prince's Trust rock and roll buddies all together. It's all the usual crew: Eric Clapton, Delaney and Bonnie, and a certain Mr. G. Harrison.
Mr. G. Harrison is there, yeah, with a spare guitar for Eric. Yeah.
So you got George, Billy Preston, and John all on stage, ending the year as they began.
Just this is what could have been.
Well, you know, it is. You know, we've all, you know, we're now in the post Get Back, Peter Jackson era, and the notion that the four Beatles should just have gotten together on stage and played some gigs, and it never comes to pass. However, George goes on the road with Delaney and Bonnie, John is rocking up in Toronto and rocking up in the Lyceum, so it's like they all kind of had vibes to play, just not play together per se, or with Paul.
Do you think Paul was a bit annoyed to open his paper the next morning and see that George and John had been on stage at the Lyceum? This is what he wanted to do in January.
Well, yeah, spontaneous gigs and happenings and things, but there's a difference, isn't there, between let's rehearse some songs, if you look at kind of the amount of rehearsal before they hit the roof in Savile Row, versus, yeah, we're just going to rock up and play, it's a blues song, off we go.
But if Paul and Ringo had been there, They could just have all got together. Delaney, Bonnie, the Beatles, Keith Moon jumps up on stage at one point. You know, the trouble is, you know, in late 1968, they're advertising the fact that the Beatles are returning to the stage. So there's an anticipation. Yeah. This is more like Paul's hit and run Wings Over the Universities tour. You know, you just kind of turn up, you do some songs off your last album or something that you're working on, rock and roll standards, and move on to the next thing. It's a kind of guerrilla tactic.
Yeah, they never, though, pick up the phone to Paul, you know, because he'd probably just want to maybe stage manage it a little bit, I don't know.
You could say that, you're team Paul, I can't say that, though.
I am team Paul. I'm trying to think, you know, Paul, he obviously likes to put out experimental records and recordings and things and does his Fireman and all the rest. Has he ever really done a gig that's been not really, you know, audience friendly?
Spontaneous, spontaneous. I mean? Not really done spontaneous.
No, like he might, like even the spontaneous stuff is kind of planned. So I don't think he's ever done anything that's kind of, like John and Yoko, you could argue that they don't have a problem with audience being antagonized.
Challenging.
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah. But
you know, you said this is kind of prefigures the Prince's Trust, but what it prefigures is rockestra.
Rockestra. Of course, that's exactly where I wasn't going. But now that you mention it,
you know, that's a very stage managed. Everybody's, you know, there's nothing loose about that. There's nothing. I mean, it's a different thing. But anyway, we're kind of descending.
But also the same thing. We are. Well, we like to go off on tangents.
We get told off for our Auntie Paul.
I'm not. Good Lord. This Lennon later refers to the band that play as the Plastic Ono Supergroup. So it's Lennon, Harrison, Clapton, Delaney, Bramlett on guitars, Clapton playing George's rocky psychedelic Fender Strat, Ono herself, Bonnie Bramlett, Alan White and Jim Gordon both on drums, Billy Preston on organ, Klaus Voorman on bass guitar, Bobby Keys on saxophone and Jim Price with his trumpet. Bobby Keys, is he still with the Stones?
No. Bobby Keys is long since
dead. Sorry. Whoops.
Basically, it was the Stones horn section.
And as you say, Keith Moon appears at one point. So
just what you want.
Well, you know, it's a good gang of people, but they only do two songs.
Yeah, but it does seem to be completely spontaneous. So John says at one point, I thought it was fantastic. We were doing the show and George and Bonnie and Delaney, Billy Preston, all that crowd turned up. They'd just come back from Sweden and George had been playing Invisible Man and Bonnie and Delaney's band. They all turned up and I said, will you come on? And they said, well, what are you going to play? And I said, we're going to do blues or Cold Turkey, which is three chords. And Eric knew that. And don't worry, Kyoko, which is Yoko's, which is three chords and riff. And I said, once we get on to Yoko's riff, just keep hitting it. So this is seems to be a genuinely spontaneous gathering.
Mm. And they play against a big war is over backdrop, because the end of 69 is when the war is over kind of logo starts appearing around the world. 2 years before the song Happy Christmas War is Over, they are putting up their billboards around the world. And so they do a version of Cold Turkey, which is about 7 minutes long. And John says at the start, you can hear him say it on the record, we'd like to do a number. This song's about pain. That's, you know, sets up the fun. Off they go into Cold Turkey. And the audience seem to recognise it. They're happy to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a single. It's a chart single. Yep. And, you know, it's a 7 minute version. And it's a fantastic version.
Mm.
Because it's just, it's like the Phil Spector sound on stage. It's just this massive sound. And I have to say, I absolutely love this version of Cold Turkey. I think the studio version is a little flat. I think Clapton lets that down. But this live version is just sensational. Probably the best live version.
Yeah. And then Yoko is quite, you know, vocal at the end of the song.
Well, she's just in a bag, you know, at John's feet. The song ends.
Yep.
And she shouts, John, I love you. Britain, you killed Hanratty. So again, there's a kind of protest element to what's happening here.
Now, the Hanratty story is one that they were intensely involved in for a period of time, John and Yoko.
As is their wont at that time, they get intensely involved for a little bit, little time.
Mm.
You know, so for while they're involved, they're very involved, and then they're not involved.
It's a case that I have to admit, it's another one of these things that if John and Yoko, you know, if I hadn't come across it via reading about John and Yoko, I don't know what I've come across it. James Hanratty was known as the A6 murderer, and he was a British criminal who was one of the last people in Britain to be executed by capital punishment before it was abolished. And he was hung in April 1962 after being convicted of the murder of Michael Gregston. Shot in a car on the A6 road in August 1961. And it became a kind of a famous case in the 60s where people were fighting the cause that he was innocent or he shouldn't have been hung or so on and so forth.
Yes, so it really did become a kind of cause célèbre. And people like Ludovic Kennedy, Paul Foote, the journalist, were very strong supporters that Hanratty was innocent, that a lot of the case really hinged on identification evidence from Michael Gregson's girlfriend, Valerie Story, who was, you know, she was subjected to a rape, she was shot, she was left paralyzed. She was the eyewitness and she gave evidence. And basically it was her testimony that convicted Hanratty. And his family were very vocal in trying to prove his innocence. And this had a very, very long tail on it. So in 1997, there was an internal police inquiry, said he was wrongfully convicted, and they referred the case to the Court of Appeal. But in 2002, the Court of Appeal ruled that a DNA test conclusively proved his guilt beyond any doubt. Now, his family and supporters are still contesting that, so it's still pressing for a review. But in 2002, that's when the DNA evidence was presented. So it basically runs from 1962 when he was hanged to 2002.
Yeah, I mean, the DNA evidence obviously wasn't around in 1962, but it seems to have proven that he was guilty. But at the time, John and Yoko, you know, were meeting with Hanratty's parents. They were, you know, they kind of trod this line, John and Yoko, by saying, well, you know, it's more to do with, you know, the state shouldn't murder people, or there shouldn't be capital punishment. And, you know, they're not, they kind of said, well, you know, it's not necessarily about his innocence. It's about, you know, capital punishment itself.
Yes. So I think from what I know about the case, the campaign seemed to reach a peak around the late 60s. So, you know, 10th of December 1969, John and Yoko meet with the parents. There's a campaign. They announced they're going to make a film. Hey, that's what they do. They make films. They went on the 14th of December. They go to Speaker's Corner and stage a silent protest. And this is, you know, it's a very John Lennon, Yoko Ono. It's a very kind of dilettante-ish thing. So they get in their Rolls Royce and they drive to Speaker's Corner, and then they get out in their bag, and while Hanratty's father addresses the crowd. So they just sit in a bag. I mean, it's from this remove, it looks ridiculous. It probably looked ridiculous at the time.
It probably was ridiculous at the time. I'm sure there are many people writing the newspapers of, you know, I can imagine columnists, what are John and Yoko doing supporting this murderer, blah, 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 blah.
But I suppose the argument in favour is the press pay attention because John and Yoko are there. So it's just the very fact that they are there, they get attention. And they do back a documentary, and which is called Did Britain Murder Hanratty? And it was released by Apple Films. And if anybody would like to see it, it is on YouTube. Everything's on YouTube.
It is there. And yeah, the John and Yoko attention machine means that, for better or for worse, we are still talking about this in 2022. They do a second song, which is a lot longer than the first song.
Yes.
Which is Don't Worry, Kyoko. And the version that they end up doing is about 40 minutes long.
This is box set gold, Jason.
We don't have this. Why don't we have this?
Sean, come on.
The whole 40 minutes on a Sometime in New York City box set? Bring it on.
They recorded the whole thing. The whole concert was recorded. Yeah. And it was mixed. So we know there is the, you know, 7, 8, 9 minute version of Cold Turkey, and there's 40 minutes of Don't Worry, Kyoko. I can hear people switching off in droves. But that's crying out for a full release, a kind of archival set. You know, there are three edits in the 15-minute version that makes the album, which is a fantastic version. But to think that there's actually a 40-minute version is just...
Lennon later describes it as the most fantastic music I've ever heard, 20 years ahead of its time. He goes on to say, a lot of the audience walked out, but the ones that stayed, they were in a trance. They all just came to the front because it was one of the first real heavy rock shows. It's only to be expected that some people were disappointed and that we only did two long numbers. But we play 1984 music. What I think is interesting from what he describes is that word trance. And, you know, something that I've certainly gotten out of Yoko's music over the years is how, you know, it's still called krautrock, but there's this very trance-like rock music that is being formulated around about this time. And this is a version of that music.
It is. You get a groove going. And she just kind of rides that groove. And here you've got George Harrison, Eric Clapton, Billy Preston, Klaus Voormann, John Lennon. These are kind of top-flight musicians that are providing this backing. And, you know, the 15-minute version, you get that sense, that kind of trance-like feeling to the whole thing.
How do you finish a 40-minute song?
Well, you just speed up. Until you can do no more. So Alan White is the drummer, and he says, while I thought Cold Turkey was good, the other number went on far too long and it began to sag. Jimmy Gordon, the other drummer from Delaney and Bonnie, and me began to speed up to bring it to an end, but we just got faster and faster and nobody wanted to stop. It was so fast that our muscles were aching. I was just about thinking, for Christ's sake, stop it, when it just sort of finished.
And then it did finish, and it was all recorded to four-track by Jeff Emmerich, with John Carlander and Peter Bowen engineering. And as you say, it was kind of mixed within the week, ready to rock.
Yeah, it was ready to go. And Mark Lewison confirms that the entire thing was recorded. So, you know, in addition to a box set for Sometime in New York City, they could actually just put out a complete, you know, like the complete Monterey, the complete Woodstock. They could put out every performance if they could clear the rights.
Did they record the whole night, not just John and Yoko's?
Yeah, not just John and Yoko, the whole night.
Oh, I thought it was just John and Yoko's.
No, no. So Mark Lewison says they confirmed the entire concert, even Emperor Roscoe's between acts records. So the compere for the night was Emperor Roscoe.
You're a big fan, I know.
I'm a huge fan of Emperor Roscoe. I've emailed Emperor Roscoe twice saying, we're doing this episode on Live Jam. Would you like to come on and share your... He won't return my emails. He won't return my calls.
He knows a stalker when he gets an email from one.
Could I just say, Emperor Roscoe is working for Radio Thameside. He should be lucky to have a stalker, you know.
Radio Thameside.
Do you know Emperor Roscoe? No.
I know he's one of the kind of the pirate ship, you know, big, loud, brash kind of. He's like a British Wolfman Jack, kind of over the top, larger than life type of DJ.
So he was a pirate radio, and then he was with Radio One in 1967.
Yeah, he was an original Radio One guy, wasn't he?
But he was the inspiration for the Philip Seymour Hoffman character, the Count, in that film, The Boat That Rocked. Have you seen the film?
I've seen that film, and it's horrible.
It is, I think. Yeah, there it is. Yeah, I'm just looking it up. Officially the worst film ever made.
It is absolutely, it's grotesque, it's factually incorrect. There's a great movie that should be made about British pirate radio, but that is not it.
And worst of all, it's not funny.
It's not funny, and then like the big kind of denouement thing at the end, the music they play over it is 1971 Who. And you're like, that is not... Oh, anyway, don't get me going. Anyway, the UNICEF Peace for Christmas gig is a good thing to be celebrated.
It is a very good thing to be celebrating. And I know I'm going to be disappointed if and when the box set ever comes out, because they're not going to go with a 40-minute unedited cut. But please put it in the box. And please, if you don't put it in the box, Sean, just send me a copy of that.
I think if we could get it. We got an awful lot of raw Yoko in the Plastic Ono Band box on the Blu-rays. So I think it's definitely up there, potentially, for the final track listing. But that is only, of course, one half of the live quarter. No, it's one live... It's a quarter... I'm doing the maths wrong. It's one half of the live half.
So it's one quarter of the whole thing, yeah.
The other quarter of the album, which is the second half of the live half of the album, is with Frank Zappa and the Mothers at the Fillmore East in 1971.
End of part one. Intermission.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
End of intermission, part two.
And we have talked about Frank Zappa before in the films of Ringo Starr and a few other bits and pieces, and I think we're kind of on the same page, you and me, with Frank Zappa, yeah. Which is...
I've tried.
The general vibe. I've tried very hard.
Yeah, I just kind of don't get... Everything is undercut by the juvenile lyrics. And I thought they were funny. When I was 13 or 14, I thought Frank Zappa was hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, I was about 14 or 15 when his book came out, and I remember coming across a copy of it and thinking, yeah, this is fantastic. It was about late 80s, the Frank Zappa book. And he seemed, you know, and I don't deny he was a very clever guy, and he, you know, artistically had a vision and he went for it and all the rest. But sometimes it's a bit tiresome, personally speaking. And yeah, the juvenilia, I think, gets in the way of the good stuff.
Yeah. He's not somebody I'd want to go for a drink with.
No, certainly not now. So they were doing a set of performances at the Fillmore East in New York City. And the whole John and Yoko rocking up with the mothers, it's a very spontaneous thing. It just happens in a day.
Seems to be. So Lennon and Zappa, I think, had never met up to this point. Lennon had talked about him, so he mentions him in the Jan Wenner Rolling Stone interview. Mm. And he seems very sort of ambivalent about Zappa. So he sort of, at one point, he sort of says, you know, I know what Zappa's going through. I'm just coming out of it now. I've just been at school again. I have a teacher's taking me off. And this is where Zappa's getting a lot of criticism. And then he says, I admire Zappa a bit, but he's a intellectual. So Lennon is in one of his cyclical moods where he's being very disparaging of the intellectual approach to rock. And there's no more intellectual approach to rock than Frank Zappa.
Yeah, I think it seems to me, reading between the lines, Lennon likes Zappa's way of getting attention, maybe likes his demeanor, might be a bit threatened by him, by the kind of the intellectual stuff he would often write off, kind of pseudo-intellectualism, if he felt it was kind of, you know, kind of an exclusive type of intellectualism, you know. And so he's kind of walking a tightrope, really.
Yes, I think he seems to blow hot and cold about Zappa.
Mm.
But the meeting, when they do meet in 1971, Zappa is at, will subsequently be at... We mentioned in the main episode that he turns up at the Everson art exhibition that Yoko does. But the initial meeting, Zappa describes this. This is him speaking in 1984, and he says, a journalist in New York City woke me up, knocked on the door, and is standing there with the tape recorder and goes, Frank, I'd like to introduce you to John Lennon. You know, waiting for me to gasp and fall on the floor. And I said, well, okay, come in. And we sat around and talked, and I think the first thing he said to me was, you're not as ugly as I thought you would be. So anyway, I thought he had a pretty good sense of humor, so I invited him to come down and jam with us at the Fillmore East. We had already booked in a recording truck because we were making Live at the Fillmore album at the time. So this seems to be completely spontaneous.
And I saw in a TV interview where he's basically recounting the same story, and he says to the interviewer, you know, he says jokingly to the interviewer, he's wrong. I'm very ugly. I'm one of the ugliest men alive. Just look at me, you know, in that sort of very laconic. I mean, for all my complaining about Frank Zappa, it's hard not to... He does have a charisma about him. You got to give him that, you know?
He does have a certain charisma. So the journalist is Howard Smith, and he had interviewed Lennon. And then whenever Lennon heard that Zappa was the next interviewee, he said, you know, can I come along? So there is some suggestion that Andy Warhol is involved in this in some way, that he is kind of setting this up. You know, Andy Warhol, little elastic sometimes with the actuality, but he didn't like Zappa at all. And there's a very weird interview from 1993, the kind of weird TV show that Warhol had in New York in the 80s. And he interviews Zappa. His entry in his diary for June 16th, 1983, is Frank Zappa came to be interviewed for our TV show, and I think that after the interview, I hated Zappa even more than when it started. I remember when he was so mean to us when the Mothers of Invention played with the Velvet Underground. I hated him then, and I still don't like him.
Yeah. Andy Warhol diaries are famously kind of quite caustic and bitchy and depressing and all the rest. But he also talks how he was very strange about his daughter. Frank was being very strange about his daughter, Moon Unit Zappa. And, you know, Andy writes, I said how great she was. And he said, listen, I created her. I invented her. Like, she's nothing. It's all me. And I mean, if it were my daughter, I'd be saying, geez, she's so smart. It was peculiar. So, yeah, they're not really... Andy Warhol had a good sense of play in, I think.
But I think they're too similar. They're two artists that just don't gel.
Yeah, that's true. The John and Yoko appearance is an encore. So they're playing these sets at the Fillmore. I think they're doing two gigs a night, and it's the end of the second night. And they are brought on, and the crowd are happy.
Why would you not be? Why would you not be happy? So the other interesting aspect of this is that Yoko, at fairly short notice, arranges for the gig to be filmed. And yeah, if you go onto YouTube, as always, there is some footage there. And it's largely maybe one or two fixed camera shots, sort of from high up, maybe in a balcony or a gallery or something. And, you know, it's interesting, and it gives you a sense of what the concert was actually like on the night. But yeah, it's an encore, and there's a guy called Richard Emmett, who was a copyist for Zappa, a music copyist, and a very long, rambling article for the Portland Songwriters Association newsletter in 2003, to which I am a subscriber. No, I'm not a subscriber. He talks about the kind of build-up before they go on stage, as recounted by Zappa. So this is not a first-hand account. And he says, Frank once described an encounter he'd had with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. I don't remember the occasion, but for some reason they were about to go on stage together in New York. According to Frank, Yoko was talking incessantly in a high-pitched voice, and John was getting more and more exasperated with her. Finally, John shouts at her, shut up, you little Jap, and Yoko socked him in the face. Ah, those golden days of peace and love. Frank's reaction, from then on, John was okay in my book.
That's a weird... Is that real?
It's on the internet. It was in the Portland Songwriters Association newsletter in 2003. The Portland Songwriters Association newsletter would not publish this if it was not true.
God, it sounds ugly.
Frank Zappa was an ugly man.
Well, it's all a bit ugly. It is worth, just in terms of getting the timeline right, their appearance is on the 6th of June, 1971. So this is not... They haven't made their permanent move to New York yet, because they go back and they leave at the end of August 71. So if we're trying to get our timeline all together, they are not New York John and Yoko yet.
They're not native New Yorkers, no.
As the song says, no, because they're back protesting in the UK in August 71, and then they move back at the end of the month. So they're a few weeks away from their... never setting foot in the UK era ever again. But they're obviously scouting around New York and getting comfortable with New York. And depending on whether you talk to the estate of John Lennon or the estate of Frank Zappa, they either play three songs or six songs. But for the sake of some time in New York City... well, it's listed as four songs on the eventual Sometime in New York City album.
It's just a number, Jason.
Yes, that's yes. the first thing they play is, well, Baby Please Don't Go, which John kind of introduces very casually as, oh, I haven't played this since The Cavern. And, you know, the audience might be thinking there's a little bit of Beatle magic about to happen. But then they launch into, well, Baby, Please Don't Go.
Yeah, which is a fantastic song, and it's a fantastic performance. And I'm here to say this might be my favourite ever Lennon vocal performance. I'm sorry, fans of Yes It Is and This Boy, but this is just... fantastic.
It is very good. It is, I think, it certainly sounds great. It may be even better than the 72 live performances that we have recorded. It's a great recording. And the actual, if you listen to just the very first second or two of the track, It does sound a little bit like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yes,
there's a little kind of dunk, dunk, dunk on the guitar. It just sounds a smidgen like it, which that would have been a fun thing for him to sing.
The Mothers are just a sensational band.
Yes.
And Zappa is an amazing guitar player. And it all just comes together on this track.
And I think, you know, that there's a lot of sneering from the Zappa camp about Yoko's screaming and Yoko's vocalizations at this time. But I think it works. Zappa, was either highly organized or there was improvisatory moments to his music. And I think, you know, that kind of teetering on chaos type vibe that sometimes comes from some of his music works well with Yoko.
This is a perfect example of what her bringing something to the table, which is not overpowering everybody else, and it does add to the performance. So John says, as you say, this is a song I haven't played since my Liverpool days, but that's not strictly true because there are studio versions of this song from the Imagine Sessions, 11th of February and the 16th of February. He recorded at Tittenhurst, several takes. This comes out on 1998, the John Lennon anthology. You can hear the studio version.
Yeah, that's right. So he obviously has it in his wheelhouse again. He's obviously brought him back into his mind.
Well, Baby Please Don't Go was written by Walter Ward, who was a vocalist with a group called The Olympics. So they had a hit in 1958 with a song called Western Movies, which got to number 8. And Well was the B-side to that.
And it is another one of these lovely things that the Beatles were obviously record collectors, record lovers. They listened to the B-sides, they put the songs that they liked into their mental musical Rolodex, and this was one of them.
This is exactly the kind of thing the Beatles were doing in 1958. They were searching for odd B-sides that other bands in Liverpool wouldn't have in their arsenal. Yeah. So it's not a song that he's suddenly reaching back 10 years. He's literally reaching back 4 months. To when he played this. And this is a song that should have been on Imagine.
Should it?
I Don't Want to Be a Soldier. That's a terrible song.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
You know what I mean? It's just one of those big spectry production numbers that you can't make out the lyrics and it just goes on and on and on. Whereas this is a great rock and roll number. And he recorded a couple of versions of it. Over 2 days. He clearly was doing it for something.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's a great song, and it evolves into what's then called on the album Jamrag.
Yes. What does that mean, Jason?
A Jamrag, do we really have to tell people?
No, I think people can work that out.
It is a euphemism for a sanitary product. And again, Yoko's doing her thing. And then the next track, so to speak, because that comes to an end, is Scumbag, which is a bit of a cheery sing-along, really. Frank is exhorting the crowd to join in.
Baby Please Don't Go is 4 minutes. Jamrag, 5 minutes, 36. Scumbag, 4 minutes, 27. Is that with my Northern Irish accent? Is that the way you say that?
I think it's just to do with Yoko's noise, but it's also the chemical element for gold, which is important to remember, AU.
There you go. So this is 8 minutes, and this is very much one of those, there's no riff, there's just noise and screaming, and I love that.
What is interesting is that at the start of at the start of it, Frank sort of says, "Good night, everybody. We'll see you next time." And Yoko's only getting started.
The night is but a pop.
Yeah, like she's then doing her half of the gig. So, you know, the band are just kind of, at least it wasn't a whole 40 minutes worth.
No.
Of seeing where it goes. But yeah, it's Yoko doing her thing.
Yeah. So, and thank you and good night. And that's it. Very good. I enjoy this. I think, Baby Please Don't Go is one of my favourite Lennon performances.
But there is the fallout as a result of the tapes, because the gentleman's agreement, I believe, is that everybody knew this was being recorded professionally. And the plan would be that John could do with the collaboration what he liked, and Frank could do with the collaboration what he liked. So, you know, the kind of the, you know, it's roughly half an hour of music that they make together, Frank and the Mothers and John and Yoko. And Zappa gives Lennon a copy of the master tapes for him to, you know, do what he wants.
Yeah. So Frank puts out an album, Fillmore East, June 1971, 2 months after the show, but there's none of the John and Yoko performances on it. So, as you say, John has a copy of the master tape and he starts doing that thing that John does, which is he starts mixing it, and the first thing he does, he puts on reverb on his voice. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm saying it's interesting to compare the YouTube video footage, the filmed footage, with what's on both John's mix and then Zappa subsequently puts out a mix. But you can hear the reverb that John is applying. He gets Klaus Voormann in to overdub mm-hmm. a new bass track. And most significantly, he takes out the backing vocals from Flo and Eddie, who are members of Zappa's band.
Yes. Yeah, he does. And then, even more controversially, is writing credits, because he gives John and Yoko all the writing and publishing. And there's interviews, even into the 80s after John dies, where Zappa is saying, yes, we had a nice time. And then it all went south because they published
yes.
the music and claimed that they'd written it themselves, even though parts of Jamrag had bits of the Zappa track King Kong
yeah.
mixed in with it. That was the kind of Zappa's complaint. Yeah.
So
they never really sorted that out.
No. So what happens is, if you have the vinyl copy of Sometime in New York City and you take the inner sleeve out for the second album, it's basically Zappa's album cover. It says, you know, Mothers, Fillmore, and then in black, it's a kind of felt-tip pen scrawl that Zappa has designed and writing on the back. So what Lennon does is he gets a red pen, and he designs something over the top of Zappa's album cover. But as you say, yes, he basically claims copyright on the entire jam. He removes Zappa's name. Walter Ward gets a credit for, well, Baby, Please Don't Go. But everything else is a kind of John and Yoko approach. And Zappa would say that his attempts to contact Lennon about this, you know, he doesn't get a response. And he comments in 1988, he says, now the horrible part of the story. During our time on stage, a number of pieces were improvised, but a number of pieces that were played were absolutely written compositions that had already been on other albums, namely a song of mine called King Kong. The deal I made with John and Yoko was that we were both to have access to the tapes and could deploy them any way we wanted. I talked to Yoko last year, which would be 1987, and I said, by the way, you remember that Jamrag? And she said, well, we have a problem with Capitol Records. We're suing them, you know. I can't imagine that album really sold a lot anyway. It's the principle. The other thing that was kind of sad was there's a song on there called Scumbag, but the way they mixed it, you can't hear what Mark and Howard, this is Flo and Eddie, the backing singers, are singing. There's a reason for that. They're singing, now Yoko's in the scumbag. We're putting Yoko in a scumbag. So John just mixes out the offending.
Well, if you watch the footage, that is what they do. They put Yoko in a bag, and Yoko screams and sings from inside the bag while Flo and Eddie are singing about her. Now, if we fast forward to March 2022 and an 8-CD box set comes out called The Mothers 1971 Box Set, which, although it finishes with their version of I Want to Hold Your Hand, in the middle of this box set on CD6, is a brand new mix of all of this music officially for the first time, I think, on a Zappa album, although part of it had originally been on Playground Psychotics, a 1992 Zappa release. But this Mothers 1971 box set, which is available in all your regular streaming places, because I have not bought it, it recontextualizes or reorders the tracks. So what we know on Sometime in New York City as being Well, followed by Jamrag, followed by Scumbag, followed by I, is on the Mothers 1971 box set is now six songs. Well, which is 9 minutes, including kind of the first bit of Jamrag. And then they've split Jamrag into Say Please, which is 1.5 minutes of Yoko screaming. And I've looked this up. The credits on this track are Lennon, Ono, Zappa. And then there's 1 minute of King Kong, which is a Zappa composition. And then there's another 3 minutes of a track that they've called Awk, because that's the noise Yoko is making, A-A-A-W-K. And that's credited to Lennon, Ono, Zappa as well. So they've broken Jamrag into these three separate songs with these three writing credits, which is interesting. And then Scumbag is the version with Flo and Eddie mixed in. So they're talking about all the things that they're putting into the Scumbag. And that is actually credited to Lennon, Ono, Kalen and Zappa. So the four of them get a writing credit. And then they've given a much more easy to pronounce title, although it's much more snarky and cynical, which is
A Small Eternity with Yoko Ono.
Yes. And they've edited out Zappa saying goodnight at the start. So it's just Yoko just comes in at the start and starts doing her thing. And that is credited to Lennon and Ono. There's no Zappa credit on that. What I would say is it is well worth seeking out this version on streaming or wherever you get your music, because I think it is mixed better. Lennon's vocals are up front and center. It's nice and clear. And, you know, give it up for the Mothers. They were a rockin' band at the time. There's a great sound on that.
They were a great band. And yeah, I mean, whatever you, please do not buy the 8-disc box set, but go and stream disc 6. And it is very good. And it's made from the master tape that Zappa gave to Lennon. Because yes, they lost Zappa, serves him right, lost the master tape. And they had to go back and say to Yoko, in 2021, would you provide the Zappa estate? So would the Lennon estate provide the Zappa estate with a copy? And they did. And I think, you know, fair play to Yoko. And I'm sure she's not in any way offended by the title being changed to A Small Eternity with Yoko.
A Small Eternity with Yoko Ono. It's, yeah, but it does sound great. And I think it's the definitive version. And again, it kind of makes you think, oh, okay, this is what a Sometime in New York City box set could sound like. Yeah. If this gig could sound this good with these people.
I think so.
It's really great.
Yeah. Do you know about Flo and Eddie? I thought, I would say you were a fan of Flo and Eddie, no?
Well, the Turtles, and they were in the Turtles, and then they get roped into this early 70s version of the Mothers, and they're very sort of high pop conceptualists.
Yeah, so Happy Together, big hit single, knocks Penny Lane off the number one spot in 1967. Chip Douglas was their bass player.
Yes, and he went off to be an essential person for the Monkees, particularly for their Headquarters album.
And Turtle Soup by the Turtles, 1969, produced by...
Ooh!
Oh, I thought you were going to say it. I thought you were going to say it. It's in the notes. It's in the notes. Oh, I do all this research.
Who's it produced by?
Ray Davis.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's his only. His only production work for any other band.
That's bizarre.
You see, I have a little note there saying side notes for Jason, Chip Douglas. Was the bass player of the Turtles until Mike Nesmith interview. Special Monkees reference for you, and then a Ray Davis reference.
I'm obviously looking at version 12 of the notes, not version 15. I do apologize.
Yeah, because you've skipped all the stuff about Flo and Eddie, and yeah, you're working off old notes.
The one thing I'll tell you is many years ago I bought a big Monkees box set for Record Store Day.
Just the one, and
I went back the following year for Record Store Day. And the guy behind the counter was like, oh, are you not going to buy the Turtles box set that's out this year? And I thought, yeah, my role isn't just to buy animal-related themed box sets. But, you know, it did cross my mind at the time, I have to admit, you know.
The Turtles are very good, but even better, if you can find it, is the Phosphorescent Leech, which is their solo album. Their first post-Turtles solo album. I'm a bit hazy on the timeline, but they have one fantastic album that you should... I don't know that it's on streaming services. If it is, we'll put up a link.
I can't remember, is it Flo or Eddie? I think it's Flo, but one of them went off and became legally qualified and kind of pursued, you know, is very vocal in copyright law.
It's a fine career.
Yeah, and musicians' rights and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, they were, along with Zappa, were very kind of prescient about owning copyrights and owning songwriting from the get-go.
We did talk about them on our 1974 episode. They had a radio show, and Ringo and Harry Nilsson pitched up very drunk, you know, with about 10 minutes to go, and they overran, and everybody was fired.
Why? Why would you do that? Would you not be delighted that they were being part of your
show?
Yeah,
but they were completely drunk and swearing, and the owners of the station...
I find that hard to believe.
The owners of the station weren't impressed. But Flo and Eddie also... Two songs they appear in backing vocals. My first single I ever bought. No, it's not actually. Get It On by T-Rex.
Oh, by T-Rex.
And somebody called Bruce Springsteen.
What Bruce Springsteen song are they on?
Hungry Heart.
Really?
Yeah.
My gosh. So I'm learning.
So yeah. So they have. Yeah, I'm just looking here at my notes. The Fluorescent Leech and Eddie, which was recorded with the Mothers after Frank fell off stage at the Rainbow in London. If you remember, yes. If you remember that story.
He was pushed off by a crazed fan.
A crazed boyfriend.
Into a 14-foot orchestra pit, and he broke his leg.
Yeah. So, and do you know what song he was playing just before he fell off the stage? I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Which is the track at the end of the current box set.
There you go. It's all connected.
So I think we have discussed an awful lot of aspects of Sometime in New York City. So I think we can only kind of wrap it up by saying this is worthy of a box set. If there's a box set on the shelves, which
it really
we're
is.
Kind of assuming there is, with 2022 mixes and all the rest, you know, there's the album itself, which could do a nice sonic polish on that. Yep. There's all this live material where we know there's extended versions. There's a CD there in the Lyceum alone. There's a CD in an expanded and remixed Fillmore gig. We know there's rock and roll outtakes and all that from the sessions as well. There's alternate versions. There's all the stuff they did with Elephant's Memory. You could even argue for the Elephant's Memory solo album could go in there.
Rehearsal tapes for the one-to-one gig and two full performances from one-to-one. It's potentially the biggest box set.
Good.
It's potentially could be a superb box set because it's such a creative period. You know, whether you like the music, whether you like the direction, it is such an intense period of creativity. It's crying out for a box set.
Well, you know, I think sometimes the best box sets will, you know, make an album that perhaps wasn't a top tier album back up to the top tier, you know, like everyone said about the Red Rose Speedway box set. But the Sometime in New York City, through the retrospectoscope, you can say, oh, actually, that is what it is. It's a record about some time in New York City. And it's the kind of the pinnacle of his diary music in some ways, him and Yoko. And it could get recontextualized and recelebrated through the lens of a decent box set.
Well, as we sit here recording, not long to go to get it out for its 50th anniversary year.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Hope springs eternal.
Perhaps if we let Sean know we're big fans and you just give us a kind of...
And we'll buy it in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That might get us attention.
We'll buy it in Bitcoin.
Yeah, we'll buy it in Bitcoin. But there you go. What do you think, everybody? I think we've made the case for a Sometime in New York City box set. We want to send you back to the records anyway and go dig out the Zappa mix of the Fillmore performances because they're well worth listening to. But let us know in all the usual places on Twitter at BeatlesPod, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, www.nothingisrealpod.com, which has links to everything, including a big list of all our Acast Plus episodes. And thank you to all our subscribers and supporters for keeping with us with the Acast Plus episodes. More stuff coming your way. But do kind of get in touch and talk about this album and what do you think. But for now, my name is Jason Carty. I'm Jason Carty. And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.